Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you on the NOLA Drinks Show, as always, every week. Well, I shouldn't say as always, because we just enjoyed a planned week off last week, so the first new show in a couple weeks or thereabouts. Yeah, it was nice to get a little break. You know, I was speaking to my lovely wife, Sylvia, not too long ago, and other than maybe a couple times over the past year and a half or so, show's been on the air for a little bit over 2 years, haven't missed too many weeks, so it was nice to get a little brain break in there. Not like this is super intelligence work there on my part. See, I can't even speak. So, you know, you're probably thinking, why does this guy even need a brain break? He probably really doesn't even have one. But anyway, nice to get a little reboot in there, get some fresh air. Speaking of which, hey, we've got some lovely weather out there here in New Orleans. If that's where you're listening or this part of the world, the fall has seemed to arrive, or at least start to arrive, I guess is probably fair to say it, you know, because we go through that period, as I've said before, I like to call faux fall, where, yeah, the calendar says fall, the temperature does not say fall, and the humidity does not say fall. But yeah, really pleasant weekend this past weekend. Had a chance to get out on Friday a little bit, which was just a beautiful day. It's the best day that we've had in months. And then had a chance to get out, if you're listening on the radio, I got out yesterday on Sunday, went over to the Blues and Barbecue, I should say Crescent City Blues and Barbecue Festival, and that's put on by the folks who do Jazz Fest, of course, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation people, and that was a really nice festival. I was actually surprised that it wasn't more crowded than it was. Now, granted, we got there pretty early, started at noon yesterday. We got there right about that time, maybe a touch after, hung out for a couple hours, saw Mem Shannon, got some good barbecue. Man, it smelled really good out there. One of the things that's always really challenging, though, when you go to these festivals, they got a couple standing tables, you know, here and there where you can kind of gather around. And we crashed a couple people's table at one point where they had some room and they were kind enough to let us join them and eat. It's pretty hard to eat barbecue when you're standing up and you can't put your drink down, or you got to put your drink on the ground. And I am notorious for spilling on my shirt. And I'm also silly enough that when I go to something like a wine tasting or a barbecue festival or anything along those lines, I always seem to wear light colored shirts, like white shirts. So, you know, every time I found myself, and remarkably, I did not spill on myself yesterday, because every time I was taking a bite, I was bending as far over as I possibly could. I'm sure I looked absolutely ridiculous, but I came away with a spotless shirt, which is a major accomplishment for this guy. But yeah, a lot of really good food. It was really fun. We had some stuff from Central City Barbecue, and had some stuff from Brats Y'all, which is the first time I've tried that. Got my wife to eat a brat. I don't know if she's ever had one before. So that was all really good. Some good music. And then, hey, we sauntered back down into the French Quarter, and our good friends Bon Bon Vivant, who, as you probably know, do the theme music to our podcast only portion, Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. And if you don't know, you should know. So if you're listening here on the radio, I encourage you to get the podcast of the show. It always comes out a day or two after we air on the radio, and we do this extended part called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, where we get a little further into the weeds with some of our guests that we have on the show. Maybe if you're like really, you know, big drink nerd or beer nerd, spirits nerd, whatever we're talking about here, wine nerd, we'll get a little further into, say, like production, for example, how maybe a distiller distills some product in particular, you know, get a little bit more technical often, or a little bit more specific about some things. And sometimes we just sort of shoot the breeze. So there you go. And that's what we do there. But Bon Bon Vivant, our good friends, I digress, they were playing on the street, as they occasionally do. Now, they're a pretty well-established band. They got some records out. They play clubs. They tour quite a bit. But what they like to do is they still like to get out in the French Quarter and busk on Royal Street right there by Cafe Amelie, is typically where they set up. And they kind of use that as an opportunity to work up new tunes. You know, they pen a lot of originals, and so they're out there just kind of, you know, practicing and trying some new stuff out, see what the crowd reaction is. They had a good crowd out there yesterday when we were there, hung out with them for about an hour, checking them out, heard a couple new tunes. Watch out for the tune called A Little Evil. It's really cool. It's going to probably be on their next record whenever that comes out. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah, I just hit a couple of our favorite establishments and that sort of thing, wandered around. So it was just a nice Sunday as we move into the fall. Friends, we got a good show coming up for you here today. As a matter of fact, the entirety of the show is really, really interesting. We chat with Lisa Wicker, who is the head distiller, and she doesn't really like to use the term master distiller or head distiller. She's very modest, but she is the head distiller. She's the distiller at Widow Jane Distillery, which is located in Brooklyn, New York. And they make some very nice expressions of bourbon. And they do, even though they're in New York, they choose to call it bourbon, which they can. We discussed that. So, you know, whiskey, of course, but they're choosing the bourbon moniker as well. And really, Lisa was just a great guest. We did this by phone and had just a great chat. So we talked quite a bit about the distillery, its backstory. We talk about her interesting background, where she started in the wine industry, got into distilling, spent some time in Kentucky. Very, very talented person, great guest. So we talk, as I said, a little bit about the distillery. We talk a little bit about the bourbon, talk about her background. And then again, on the podcast only portion, another shot with Nola Drinks. She sticks around and we talk a little bit and talk about a couple different things. But one thing that I want to highlight that we talk about is, you know, the importance of her and how she views being a woman in the industry. And I think there's some really great insight that she brings to the table about being a woman and a successful one, very talented one in her position, and working in an industry that many, especially bourbon, might perceive as being very male dominated. And there's a truth to that. I'm not saying there's not, but there's a lot more women doing stuff with bourbon and whiskey than you might think. So we touch on that quite a bit, which is also some really cool stuff. So that's going to be our show coming up here in just a second. We're going to move it over to the phone interview with Lisa, and then please do go get the podcast if you're listening here on the radio, and get that at noladrinks.com. It is on your favorite platform: Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. I'm leaving a couple out: TuneIn Radio, Nitty Grits Media, which is the National Food and Beverage Foundation, their podcast network. So you can get all those different places, or just go to noladrinks.com, because we got that information right there for you. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drinks Show, then we're going to be back with Lisa Wicker from Widow Jane Distillery. Come on, man.
I'm going to take you out, girl, and spend some time. If I do.
Brian Diaz here with the Nola Drinks Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit SAWineWeekNola.com. Cheers, y'all. All right, everybody, Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome back to the show, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hey, yeah, we are chatting with Lisa Wicker, who is a distiller at Widow Jane, a very fine distillery all the way up in the great state of New York in the Red Hook neighborhood of Brooklyn. And Lisa, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you. And it was fun. We were just chatting before we went on the air, before we started taping this portion of the show. And so you're there at Widow Jane, a really interesting distillery located really right in the Red Hook neighborhood, as I said, of Brooklyn. Tell us a little bit about the distillery.
The distillery proper, the actual physical property, is about a block and a half from the water, which is really lovely. So, you know, when you need a break, you can run down and wave at the Statue of Liberty.
Nice.
And I really enjoy the neighborhood. It's a little gritty. It's very colorful. The culture's really rich here. There's a lot of old mafia tradition.
Ah, okay.
Lots of stories and legends coming out of this neighborhood. When you step over the threshold, it's like every other distillery in a really wonderful way. You just it doesn't really matter whether you're in the city or the countryside. You know, it's still a really wonderful environment here. We have some challenges with the physical property, just because we have to distill, we cook, mash, and distill on different levels. And so fermentation's downstairs, and cooking's upstairs, and distilling's another way upstairs. And we have chickens in the courtyard. So my residence is in Bardstown, Kentucky. And so, you know, it's really great. I've got trees and chickens out the window, so it's not all a whole lot different. But the distillery has a Carl pot still. It's a really lovely still. It's a really lovely system. It's a Carl pot into two columns. We don't run the second column because we're not purifying our whiskey that much.
Okay.
Currently, we were using, when I started with Widow Jane last summer, I was a consultant, and we started with some corn that they'd already been working on. It was an open pollinated heirloom cross, and I inherited that, and so we got started with it. They hadn't cooked in a while, and
Lisa, where do you guys source the corn at the moment?
We are corn at the very moment. I just had heirloom corn, an open pollinated cross between Bloody Butcher and Wapsie Valley, and we grew it in Kentucky.
Okay.
We grew it in upstate New York, and we grew it in Pennsylvania. I've got seed corn in Pennsylvania, New York. I have all the New York production corn grown in New York, and as we're getting ready to grow the distillery and enlarge it, we have an opportunity to distill some of it back in Kentucky. And so I had all that corn grown in Kentucky. And then over the years, what we'll do is we expand here. We'll shift all of that growing, that corn, to upstate New York and have it grown there.
Okay.
So I'm really committed to having the corn grown where it's distilled. Last year, we inherited corn that had already been grown in Pennsylvania, and it was really lovely, and it really made some fabulous whiskey. And like I said, we decided to the company gave me the opportunity to work with the best growers in Kentucky, Peterson Farms. They grow corn for Maker's Mark and Sazerac and a few other people. I don't know if I'm allowed to name everyone. they grow some small grains as well, but we're the first heirloom project that they took on.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
Yes. And so it was very exciting. Bernard Peterson, who I deal with mostly there, he has had several craft distillers approach him about heirlooms and things, and they just weren't willing to do it. Fortunately for me, his daughter lives in New York, and I'm like, please come see me, come visit. And I think I had him, if he was sitting next to me, I think I had him after he stepped over the threshold and realized what was going on here.
Okay.
We had a great conversation, and he agreed to grow the corn. And so,
way to play the family card right there, Lisa. That was a good move.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And literally, it's 20 minutes, where we grew, it was 25 minutes from my home, 20 to 25 minutes from my home.
Hey, look, and Lisa, you also didn't have to play the mafia card that you just mentioned. You could just stop at the family card.
I didn't have to play the mafia
card. Right.
I am from the Midwest. I don't know how to play the mafia card, but I sure as hell give it a go. But I keep waiting for it. I think our warehouse is haunted, actually. But on another note, but yes, we had, so I was able to find a farmer in upstate New York who was very willing to take this on, because that's all he does is open pollinated heirloom corn. So Kentucky, we were fortunate. We got free input from the University of Kentucky agronomist there and the agronomist on the staff of Peterson Farms. Everybody was excited about it. We held our breath. You can't get this crop insured yet until it's been proven over a few years. And so the company was fabulous in the fact, Sampson and Surrey, that they were willing to support this project. I did have some sleepless nights. I did drive out every time we had a windstorm to make sure, because some of these heirloom corns, standability is one of the issues. It likes to collapse sometimes in the bad weather, but the agronomists knew what they were doing, and we had great success. We broke all kinds of yield records for heirloom corn, it's beautiful.
Oh, that's
absolutely
cool. Okay.
Stunning.
Lisa, so people know too, and we don't have to go down this road, but you mentioned Sampson and Surrey, and so they're partners with you all at Widow Jane, friends of the show here, so you're connected with them as well as the distillery, the Widow Jane distillery itself. But let's touch on this really quick, and then I want to get back into maybe some of the backstory of the distillery before we take a break. But I think it's really interesting because you were just talking about this, and you mentioned this when we were chatting before we went on the air. You're very, obviously, very well connected and active in overseeing the agricultural side of this, which I know a lot of distillers, obviously they're concerned with that, but that's not necessarily their bailiwick. And you're very hands-on with what's coming out of the field and then into the mash.
Yes, I even got to sit in the combine for part of harvest.
Oh, that's cool.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
It was very cool. It was very cool because we had these amazing conversations about, what would be done differently next year and where things could have gone badly and where things went really, really well. So the whole project was really, really exciting and successful, but I have to hand it to Peterson Farms. They know what they're doing, and they were willing to take on this project, and it's just been a win-win all around right now. I hope they're thinking the same thing.
That's great. And I love what you say, sparing everybody who listens to the show knows I worked in the wine industry in California for a long time. And I'm a big fan of the idea of you let people do what they're good at. You let farmers farm,
yes.
Right? They know what the hell
yes.
they're doing.
Yes. And, you know, and you can build the relationships too. I mean, you know, Bernard's been on my front porch in Bardstown, you know, sitting in a rocking chair, and we've had a little whiskey, you know, it's great.
Great. Well, do me a favor, Lisa, tell us a little bit about the distillery itself, like the history. It's a cool building. We'll get into that. And there's a connection to chocolate, which makes me happy. And we'll get into that too. But tell us a little bit about the distillery, the story.
And I am the weakest link of everyone here on the staff because everyone here has been well established and been here, some of them since the beginning. The 6-year anniversary party is on Friday. It was started by a gentleman that first started the chocolate cacao prieto from the building, and then it evolved into whiskey. So chocolate and whiskey, right? It's the best.
What a great pairing. And if you didn't know, yes. Now you know.
Yes. And so, like I said, I'm going to be careful not to misspeak about any of the history, because like I said, I don't know it. I'm not as well versed in it as I should be. And then it was acquired, the total 100% change in ownership with Sampson and Surrey. Oh, I guess it'll be 2 years in the spring.
Oh, okay.
That they acquired Widow Jane. One of their commitments is to keep the craft distilleries that are in the portfolio completely independent of one another as far as staffing and ideas
and the identity,
true to
right,
their brands.
Sure.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Because, you know, and people that are close to me know, I've said over and over again, the worst thing that could happen is somebody could say, oh, this tastes like the other guys, right? And that's not what we want to happen.
What you
we want to
do, stay, right.
Right, exactly. We want to keep sure that we're true to all the different expressions.
Now, Lisa, the chocolate production still continues, though, right? You guys are making chocolate there in the facility as well.
Yes, it's kind of a separate company now.
Okay.
Yes, but we do. You know, we put it gets noisy in here, but it smells amazing, right? People
sure.
are just always just bowled over when they walk through the front door and they smell whiskey and chocolate at the same place.
That's pretty remarkable. Cool. So, I mean, what if anything, it allows you all to like go grab some chocolate to drink with the whiskey and vice versa, right? Everybody's
right.
keeping everybody happy, I'm guessing.
Right. Right.
I like that. Okay, that's good. Let me ask you this question. We're going to take a break here in about 2 or 3 minutes, but and we'll taste through the one expression that we have here that we're going to sample. But I think it's really interesting. The one that we're tasting is the 10-year straight bourbon whiskey. And let me ask you this very specific question. We'll get into the flavor profile and all that after the break. But I think it's, you know, as you well know, and I think a lot of listeners probably know this, but a lot of listeners probably don't know this, that, you know, everybody so strongly associates bourbon with your home state of Kentucky, but really anything, there's a couple main considerations, a few others to be, you can, anything made in the United States up to a certain spec and made with 51% corn can be called bourbon, right? And
yes.
So I think, but it's such an interesting choice because I think a lot of people outside of Kentucky stay away from calling their whiskey bourbon, even though they can. And you guys chose to do that, which I think is really cool.
Yes. It's, you know, Act of Congress, 1964, mm-hmm. You know, and I love my neighbors dearly, but there's a lot of people in Kentucky that still believe that bourbon can only be made in Kentucky. But Congress, 1964, you know, 51% corn, brand new charred oak barrels. They don't even have to be American. It's actually, it sounds like there's a lot of rules, but there aren't really. It's kind of an outline that, you know, there's certain things that you have to hit, but there's certainly still a lot of creative freedom.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't dictate what type of corn or that over 51%, how much has to be in it. But, you know, then, you know, it's straight bourbon after 2 years, Kentucky straight after 4.
Yep. But. Okay. And that's what you guys have done here, which is really very cool. And I think it's really interesting because I think I always kind of scratch my head and I go, why don't more people outside of Kentucky call it bourbon? And I mean, I get the idea, for example, that Tennessee, you know, they've really tried to create their own consideration. So hence calling it Tennessee whiskey and so on to create an identity. But being able to use that term bourbon, especially these days with as hot as the category is, I think it's a great idea.
It's a wonderful idea. It's a wonderful idea. And as more and more people get educated, they're starting to understand that, you know, it's about the quality of the product and the flavor of the product and not necessarily what state that it was originated from.
Absolutely right. It's going for some character there and stuff like that. Well, let's do this, if you don't mind, Lisa. Let's take a little break here on the show, and then we're going to come back and we're going to taste through some of this stuff. So that'll segue very nicely from what you just said. We'll talk a little bit more about the whiskeys that you make, the different expressions, and we're going to get a little bit more about your story as well. Can you stick with us for a little bit?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Absolutely. No problem. Friends, we are chatting with Lisa Wicker, who is the distiller at Widow Jane up there in Brooklyn, New York. And a great conversation here. We're going to taste some really cool bourbon whiskey.
Orange to rake,
scraping down. Take a little break here, friends, on the No Drink Show. Come on back.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me oh my.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. We are chatting with Lisa Wicker, who is the distiller at Widow Jane, a very fine artisanal craft. We'll use that term. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and use it. Distillery up in Brooklyn, New York. And Lisa, thanks again for taking some time out. And how's life up there in New York right now? How's the weather?
It's actually really beautiful today. It's more summerish than it is fallish. But yeah, we've had a few really great days, but it's really sparkly pretty today.
Oh, that's great. That's great. As we're taping this, so for listeners that know, this is actually airing on the radio on Monday and then the podcast out on Tuesday. We actually taped this last week in the middle of the week. So, you know, it's actually really lovely weather here. It's about to turn into the fall. Fortunately, we were up until really today, Lisa, in the midst of what I like to call faux fall, because even though the calendar turns, it's absolutely meaningless when it's still 91 degrees outside and the humidity is 90%.
Yes, we're actually suffering or enjoying the same thing, depending on what your perspective is.
Yeah, I'm going to go suffering, but yeah. Well, Lisa, tell us a little bit about your background. You mentioned in passing that you're originally from Kentucky, and now you're finding yourself there in New York. But how'd you get involved in the world of distilling?
I keep telling people I need to streamline this story a little bit because it's kind of long and boring. I was actually raised in Southern Indiana, Indiana University, Bloomington.
Oh, okay.
And I was actually raised with someone whose father had started a winery, and he was a law professor at Indiana University, and it was a weekend hobby sort of thing that he decided to make a viable family business. He went with some other people that I know, and he went to the state government and got a lot of laws changed. And so I was actually in their home sometimes when, you know, some of that things, those conversations were happening. It's the first place I got my head around the idea that you could actually make alcohol for a living. Now they're one of the largest wineries outside the state of California.
Oh, really? Who is that? Out of curiosity.
It's Oliver Winery out of Bloomington, Indiana.
I've heard of them. Sure. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, That was my first exposure to it. Got married, had three children, worked in the arts for years, moved a lot, and came back to Indiana, and a man that I had known for years knew I didn't mind getting dirty, and he kept begging me to come to work for him, and owned a small winery, a family winery. It's actually a medium-sized family winery. I shouldn't call it small. And finally, one day, I said, yeah, I'm going to go to work for you. And 3 days in, I knew that's what I was supposed to be doing. I'd been running a costume shop that I had founded for a professional dance company and kind of an underserved arts area, and jumped on the opportunity to get back outside. I'd been working as I jumped on a chance to be with two moms from who I still am friends with. They're really dear women that kind of jokingly said, you know, you want to cut grapes with us, we're going to take this job. They were working for a winery, and I'm like, sure. And so we ended up being farmhands all fall, you know.
Okay.
Much to our children's embarrassment, I think, but and so that, you know, that kind of launched it for me, and it got hired by one of the, like I said, the man that he was buying grapes from this other winery, and it just took off. And I got fortunate, a woman, Ellie Butts, she was a retired Purdue professor. She still works for Lallemand Yeast, and I got very fortunate, and she befriended me and mentored me during my wine part. Plus, I was trained by a really talented man, David Schroed, and between the two of them, you know, I was able to patch my education together and continue to learn. When my youngest graduated from high school, I got an offer to move to Kentucky to build a winery in Kentucky. And I jumped on it because I wanted to learn, you know, the winemaker, he and I, you know, we were making wine. We'd be drinking whiskey in the evenings, right? And, you know, now sometimes I make whiskey all day and I go home and drink wine. But
you know that story, right? And you know, that old, you know, you worked in the wine industry like I do. You know that joke is like, what does it take to make wine?
Yes.
A lot of cold beer or whiskey, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. So true. It's so true. But the winemaker there gave me the bug to start to, you know, to try to figure distilling out. So I get to Kentucky, which actually has the second oldest oldest wine tradition in the United States. It was the second largest wine producing state in the country before Prohibition. Thomas Jefferson had sent rootstocks down the Ohio River, and the first commercial vineyard was actually established in northern Kentucky.
I don't want to get too far. Sorry, Lisa, to interrupt, but too far off topic here. Were these some of the original, like Norton, and some of the original hybrid grapes?
No,
It was vinifera.
And that's the reason it was not successful, right?
Gotcha.
Kentucky actually has a lot of microclimates, and so sometimes some of them are successful for several years. In fact, there's, you know, a French monk monastery that, you know, they tended a successful vineyard for 100 years in Kentucky. There's lots of microclimates. And so depending on, where you're growing them, you know, with the climate shift a little bit, it's, you know, people are struggling a little bit.
Sure.
So the Department of Agriculture there had kind of tried to work to reestablish the wine industry because everybody after Prohibition was too poor to plant a vineyard and then wait on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they planted tobacco, they planted corn because corn was an instant cash crop for the whiskey industry
starting back up
after Prohibition. So I went down there, thought, you know, I'm going to learn to distill. I meet Steve Beam, Limestone Branch Distillery in Lebanon, Kentucky, and we kind of joked for a while that he had a building and no license. I had a license and no building. I was working in a retrofitted barn until I got to time to build the winery. And so we built the winery, and we were each other's extra set of hands in the evenings, and the owners of the winery went through a really spectacular divorce, and I saw the writing on the wall, booked a ticket to California, hit up some friends in Northern Sonoma thinking, I'll work a harvest there, regroup. Well, the day after I resigned, I'd been doing enough work at Limestone Branch, the day after I resigned the winery, Paul and Steve Beam took me to dinner and offered me a full-time position. And so I got my foot in the door much earlier than I ever anticipated. I'd already been working with some of their products in the evenings on blending and some fermentation work and things. And we actually had a project that I had started, a commercial project where I was doing some brandy bases at the winery, and we were able to shift those back to the distillery. So that all went really well. I was there almost 3 years until Luxco purchased them and I got fired.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, Luxco, the Everclear people. Yeah. Now, since then, Luxco's built Lux Row in Bardstown, but they bought Limestone Branch, and that gave Paul and Steve Beam an opportunity to bring back their old family brand of Old Yellowstone. Yes, that label had been owned. Steve's mother was a Dant, and dad was a Beam. And so that label had been traded back and forth between both families, and it gave them an opportunity to bring that label back home. So I did a short stint on consulting and thinking I'm having to get back to winemaking. And then Ted Huber of Starlight Distillery in Southern Indiana had added a grain distillery. I'd known him for years because of winemaking, and they had a winery that's, I think, 35 years old. And I got picked up by Ted. It was great. I had a couple offers from some really outstanding distilleries and got really fortunate that Ted came through. And so I thought I'd stay with Ted forever. And Drew Colesbean, the master distiller from Willett, is a friend in Bardstown, and he threw my name in the hat because a family friend wanted to build a small craft distillery in Bardstown and threw my name in the hat for that. And I got hired to oversee that project. Thought I was going to stay on as the distiller there. My family's like, you're going to be bored. And during that time, I decided to go out on my own and start a consulting business. And my boss turned up and called me and said, you know, we're interested in working with you. And I was a little reluctant at first, but he flew up to Kentucky, and we went to dinner, and 10 minutes into dinner, thinking, same thing as when I started winemaking, thinking, I'm going to go to work for this guy, right?
Yeah.
And he's got the vision, and this is everything that I want to hear, and he's been true to his word ever since, but so it's been a wild ride, and so the first thing I did, you know, was come back and start working with Widow Jane. I've been able to I have not had as much time to work with any of the other brands, which is fine because I love it here.
Sure.
And we got, like I said, we got them back up and running after 19 months of not distilling. And
Which has got to be a great reward in and of itself, right? I mean, that
it is, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And things are going well, and I'm looking forward to the expansion. We started expanding here a little bit. We're looking at the feasibility of doing that and realizing that we needed to go a lot bigger than we thought originally. So we'll be shifting, like I said, you know, shifting production to New York down the road.
Sure, as you can. Okay, well, let's do this, Lisa. Let's take a little break right now, and then we're going to come back, and I've been sipping the whole time. I know you poured yourself some, so I hope you've been sipping too.
Yes.
We're gonna talk about the whiskey a little bit and talk a little bit about the water. It's an interesting story. And then, of course, you're going to stick around for our podcast-only portion, Another Shot with Nola Drinks. So if you're listening, friends, on the radio, make sure that you get the podcast. But, hey, we're going to take a quick break here, friends, on the Nola Drinks Show. Come on back.
But on Saturday night, they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday Night Fish Fry. It was rockin'. It was rockin'. You never see such scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn.
Brian Diaz here with the Nola Drinks Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit SAWineWeekNola.com. Cheers, y'all.
Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand. I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it.
Yeah, all right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for listening in this week. As always, do be sure to check us out on social media at Nola Drinks on Instagram and Facebook, and at Nola Drinks One on Twitter. We are chatting with Lisa Wicker, who is the distiller up at Widow Jane Distilling, a whiskey distillery located in Brooklyn, New York. And we were talking a little bit earlier how y'all call it bourbon, which I think is really cool. And it's actually, technically, this is a straight bourbon whiskey that we're tasting here. So tell us a little bit, Lisa, about what we're tasting here, the Widow Jane 10-year straight bourbon whiskey.
This is the original part of the project that I inherited. It's sourced whiskey. You know, there's always a debate, and when you're starting up a craft distillery, do you make cash flow product or do you source whiskey? My personal take on source whiskey is the fact that, learning history back in Bardstown, it's how millers got paid. You know, they get excess grain, somebody would distill it turned into barter and cash,
right?
And people would sell each other's whiskey. So it's really a really old tradition. It's a way, you know, if this guy didn't have anybody, had a customer, he was able to go to his buddies and you know, and source some whiskey, right, and sell it under another label. And it's been,
sure,
happening forever, and for some reason it's frowned upon. But as long as there's complete transparency, you know, I know we've had some issues with that, you know, in the craft world, but as long as everybody's completely transparent, I don't see that there's any problem with it.
You know, Lisa, look, sorry to interrupt you. I think coming from the wine industry, you'll understand this very well. Like we talked about, let farmers farm. And we know that in a lot of instances, for example, you could be a winery located in a particular location and you want to make a Chardonnay. If Chardonnay doesn't grow well there,
right,
you know, get it where it grows well, and get people, if they make something that you like, if they make something to your character, to your identity, to your spec, there, absolutely, as you said, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right, exactly, exactly. So this whiskey, Widow Jane, we're committed to keeping the age statement on the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And so as source whiskey, everybody that's following, and all your serious people out there will understand, some of those stocks are drying up, and you can't find them like you used to. And like I said, so many brands were established on source whiskey initially. So the idea was that we were going to go to small batch, but there's no government definition on small batch. And so in order to keep the expressions very close to what they are as a single barrel, But with whiskey coming from different origins, we decided to keep it at five barrels. We define it ourselves, and we've gone into a five-barrel small batch expression.
Okay, cool. So, because you guys do, and I want to make sure that we know that you guys do have different expressions going on, and you noted too earlier that the idea is to move this to a whole local consideration as far as sourcing your grains locally. Yes. and everything.
Right.
And that takes time. And I think everybody knows that that takes time to be able to do that. So, you know, getting what your vision is in line and getting stuff that you want to have made and, you know, sourcing stuff that fit what you're trying to accomplish is great. And that's what you've done here.
Yes. And that way we can let our whiskey age naturally, because we all know you can't fake age. You can enhance the whiskey on a short term. You can add a lot of different flavor notes, different points on a spectrum, but you can't get overall what you can get with just time.
Sure. And yeah, absolutely.
And season change and everything. And so, yep. You know, that's always, it's like I said, it's really interesting sometimes what some arguments come under fire. But if somebody, I jokingly say that putting whiskey back is like a reverse pyramid scheme, right? All the money is going out the door, and mm-hmm. you're not going to sit on it for a long time. You're mm-hmm. not going to see any of it coming back in the door for a long time. And in order to be viable, you've got to come up with something to fill the gap. And so we'd like to keep the age statement. And so all the stock we're putting back now, we'd like to hold on for 10 years. And in order to do that, you know, we've decided that we're going to keep a really excellent, excellent product on the market, and this is how we're going to accomplish it.
Yeah. Hey, look, and that's because that's what we're talking about keeping to your identity, keeping that name statement mm-hmm. on there, which, as you just noted, for various reasons of supply, it's hard to be able to do that. Got to have a plan to do that, and you've got to be able to have the fortitude these days, yeah. basically, to be able right. to do that. Well, and with this one in particular, Lisa, that I noticed that I really liked when I first popped the bottle, and as we all do when we work in this business and do this kind of thing, I stuck my nose in the bottle right when I popped it open.
Of course.
And, of course. And I'm a true professional. And, mm-hmm. you know, I noticed that the ripe fruit, like dark stone fruit, was the first thing that jumped out at me on the nose, which I think is really very pleasant. And then, I mean, there's lots of good things we can talk about here going on. And the other thing, though, that I found really interesting, too, as I sipped it, and I've been enjoying this this afternoon quite a bit, is, as you can probably tell by the quality of my interview, is that there's a very...
I'm trying to catch up.
you're doing great. I'm throwing this under the bus. But, you know, there's a really nice, like a flinty note that is sticking with it through the finish that I think is really cool also. Like a pencil shaving kind of note.
Yes, it's really an interesting because it's the single barrel expression that you're tasting. Of course, there's some common notes in it. You know, there tends to be a lot of honey notes, sometimes a white raisin. You're holding on to an oak note, I'm assuming, because
yep.
of
sure.
the way you're describing it.
Yep.
And the finish can vary a little bit, but lots of cherry. You know, it yep. can be a cherry bomb sometimes in some of the barrels.
Absolutely. That's like that dark cherry kind of note. I get that on both mm-hmm. the aroma and on the palate. Mm-hmm. And I mean, certainly you get like those baking spices on the finish, but I thought that mm-hmm. pencil shaving mm-hmm. note that really hangs nicely from the mid palate all the way through the finish was really interesting and really pleasant.
Yes, it is. And is. And that's purely from the barrel. You
gotcha.
Know, that's
sure.
not, yeah.
Yep. Well, let's talk about this. We got about 2.5 minutes or so before we have to close the radio portion here, Lisa. It's a really interesting story. So you guys get the water for what you're doing moving forward, I'm assuming, or is it for maybe for this one as well? So it's water found in an old mine on a limestone aquifer, correct?
Yes. And we're doing something that's a little bit unusual with it, or a lot unusual, is the fact that we're using it to proof the whiskey. And so when you get back into like the science geekdom part of it, it's not the best choice for that because it likes, you know, calcium likes to throw, you know, like
yep.
flock and things like that. And so, you know, there's those issues. We choose not to chill filter. So I did come up with a proprietary sort of system so that we're not chill filtering, but we're keeping it clear and clean and polished.
Okay.
And it seems to really have enhanced the whiskey. But you can't match. It's a difference between putting a pure bottle of mineral water down, you know, maybe like Perrier or something, and then putting it against something that's like an artificially carbonated seltzer water. So you get those beautiful minerals and a minerality to it. You know, we're both wine people too from our backgrounds, right?
Yeah.
So you get that gorgeous minerality that sometimes you can get in, you know, some of the like the Rhone whites and things.
Exactly.
you know, and so that's, it's beautiful in the whiskey. It's a really beautiful expression. The Rosendale Mines are in Rosendale, New York. There's lots of folklore and legend surrounding Widow Jane up there, but we're sourcing all the water from Rosendale. We have it trucked in a stainless tanker and transferred to a stainless steel tank, and we use it for proofing the whiskey down.
That's really cool, and I know, and I don't want to go get too far into this because we've now got about a minute and a half left before we got to close this out, but it was a vaunted mine for Rosendale cement, a very famous type of cement. So there are certain things like parts of the Brooklyn Bridge, the White House, the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty come from the cement. And now it's helping, I should say, produce some very, very fine bourbon whiskey.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I, and the staff here and things, the team here is just remarkable, you know, and so I got fortunate that I could just walk in and inherit this project. Right. So those things were already established. I'm just here to carry it on. Right.
Yeah, and you're doing a fine job. Well, let's do this, Lisa. Do me a favor. Tell people very quickly the website. People can visit the distillery. I know that. But how do people find you online?
WidowJaneDistillery.com. Yeah, it's really easy. Okay. Yeah, we should pop right up at the top.
Yeah, and you can come visit the tasting room, go take a trip out to Red Hook, Brooklyn there, and you guys are open, you have tours and stuff and all that,
absolutely.
All that really cool stuff. So what we're going to do, friends, here, we're going to close out the radio portion of the show, as I mentioned, and Elisa's going to stick around, and she's going to join us for another shot with Nola Drink, so we're going to talk a little bit further about the whiskey, get a little bit more of her perspective about working as a woman in the industry, and we'll probably get a little geekier here on the bourbon, friends. So if you're listening on the, there you go. If you're listening on the radio, thanks for listening in this week. And if you are listening on the radio, please go get the podcast because we're going to have a lot more fun coming up and we're going to drink some more bourbon. So friends, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all. Everybody, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Hey, hope you enjoy and are enjoying that conversation that we're having with Lisa Wicker of Widow Jane Distillery up there in New York. We're going to bounce it right back in that direction in just a second. And then after that's over, I'll be back with my parting shot talking about some record-breaking bottles being sold at auction. Here we go. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Yep, we are chatting with Lisa Wicker, who is the distiller at Widow Jane Distillery all the way up there in Brooklyn, New York. And great chatting with you, Lisa, and getting to know you. You mentioned when we were chatting before we started recording here a while back, you have a relationship to Southeast Louisiana and Louisiana, a little family connection, don't you?
I do. My children's paternal grandparents, their grandmother grew up in New Orleans and their grandfather grew up in Lake Charles.
So, yeah,
and
okay.
They're descended from Jean Lafitte's money launderer.
No way. Okay, you just played the mafia card again, whether you realized it or not. Yeah, wow, no way. Okay, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know who that guy was, but, you know, it's not, it wasn't Jean himself. But
that's
yeah,
by
yeah,
design.
Absolutely.
You don't know who he was, right?
Right. Right. Yes.
Well, that's
yes.
A, do you make it down to these parts from time to time?
I do, but it's been a long time. We used to make a regular pilgrimage, and now that my children are grown, we don't get there like we used to.
So. Gotcha. Okay. Well, so let me ask you this question. And one of the things that I mentioned to you before that we talk about a lot on the show are, you know, just issues of diversity and social issues and things like that as it relates to the hospitality industry and food and liquor industry and so on. And, you know, being a female, being a woman in the industry, working as a distiller, I think it's a really important thing to know. And I'd love to get your opinion about, you know, what you think it means to the industry as well as what it means to you to be an accomplished woman doing what you do.
Well, you know, it's, I keep always go to background, right? And some of the background that I have, women used to do the distilling. It was a household chore, it was
right.
A kitchen chore, right? When the toys started getting shiny and big, you know, then guys started jumping in and, you know, doing this,
right,
the distilling, right? There's some people, some historians that believe like the first mash bills and things that were written down possibly by miller's wives, because, you know, the millers like gets off excess grain. It's like, here, honey, I've got all this corn this time, I've got all this wheat this time, and if it sits there, it's going to go bad, right? The critters are going to get in it and it's going to spoil. But if you turn it into distilled spirits, you have, guess what? You've got something to barter. You have something for medicine. You have something for enjoyment, right? And
yep.
So, you know, that's the reason there's so many old recipes, too. I'm also, I've been the key consulting distiller for George Washington's rye whiskey now for, I'm going into my third season there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And yeah, so the history thing is, you know, like huge for me, right? And Steve Bajor is the director of trades there. He, you know, we've compared lots of notes about distilling starting in Maryland, where it started to shift, where the people left Maryland and went into Kentucky and crossed the, you know, the Cumberland Gap. And so you go back into all these old accounts, and women were there, you know, until it started to be more of a big commercial venture, and that's where, you know, the women were not participating as much anymore. So you move forward a couple hundred years, and I've spoken on two women's panels this past about 3 months. One of them was last week for the Nashville Whiskey Festival, and really what you discover is people really are looked at for what they have accomplished and what they are accomplishing. You know, there's always some joking stories about people thinking that, and that I'd mean no disrespect for people that, you know, thank goodness they're out there on the front line for me, or I wouldn't be able to do what I do. But, you know, they're like, oh, you know, even when I was in winemaking, it's like, oh, all the marketing people are down the hallway. I'm like, I'm a production person. But that was both men and women making that bias,
uh-huh.
Right? That was
yeah.
Not particularly men. And what I've discovered it was so helpful in winemaking, and even more so in distilling, is everybody has been bent over backwards. It's been really remarkable run for me. You know, I think when you respect what they do and you respect what they're teaching you, and then you put in the backbreaking part, you know, you're scraping trench drains with a putty knife, right? And
right, got to do the work, right?
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. Inside tanks and scrubbing those down and staying in the late hours and, you know, getting yourself soaking wet at 2:45 in the morning, and it's in the single digits outside and you cry all the way home in your truck, you know?
Right.
You know, but the respect, you know, you get the respect out of all that, right? You know, you've put in the hours and you've put in the work, and really, I think that's, you know, when you haven't taken any shortcuts, there really hasn't been any bias. And I sat on a panel recently with another two women, and the same thing, Michael Veach, he's the bourbon historian in Louisville, Kentucky, right? And he was the mediator, and, you know, he threw the question out, and it almost died before he got out. All three of us are like, well, the other two women have chemical engineering backgrounds, right? And none of us were all like, well, we've been fortunate that, same thing. They started out in engineering, and so they were already being accustomed to being, you know, in the minority there. I hate to use that word.
And at least was perceived as a male-dominated space, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know if it's difference in personality. I'm certainly, all the women I spoke with in Nashville, we can all hold our own, you know,
mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that has something to do with it. There were no what do I want to say, kind of wildfire personalities in the group. Everybody was certainly a go-getter and has put in the work. Everything, you know, from Alyssa Henley's making her own charcoal and Ashley Barnes, who's, you know, directing traffic at Four Roses and, you know, my heroes, right? And Andrea Wilson, who is, you know, she, along with Pam Heilman, they're the two top dogs at Michter's, right?
Yep.
And they're wonderful, talented women, have been overlooked for a long time in the industry. You know, people are always surprised to find out how long that those two ladies have worked and how much they've accomplished in their careers. You know, they haven't gotten a lot of press. And then, you know, Jane Bowie from Maker's Mark, she's, you know, came out of marketing, but is now a master of maturation there. And Nicole Austin, who is one of the, you know, the original female craft distillers at Kings County, then was in Ireland for a little while and is now back. And she's a master distiller for George Dickel now.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So really, you know, I really don't have any dirt on it. You know,
That's great. You see, I mean, and I think you just said something that's fantastic, Lisa, is that, you know, probably a lot of folks are not getting the recognition that they deserve. People are there. They need that recognition needs to be given because it's totally merited and has been earned. But people with like your voices out there and some of the fantastic women in the industry that you just mentioned are, I think are, you know, we got a long way to go. I'm going to argue with diversity in this broader industry of spirits and hospitality as it relates to all kinds of different groups. But I think that we see at least some shift in the landscape. I'm hoping. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. 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 Well, I'm at an age where, you know, I wasn't encouraged to study science and chemistry and things in high school, and I wish I had been. You know, you look back and it's not, there really isn't any woe is me story in it. It's just everybody has a different path, right? Do I wish I had a stronger background than that? Absolutely, because I do math and chemistry every single day for work.
Right.
But the opportunity is still there. You know, you just figure out your own way and you figure your own path, and it all still comes together. I've been fortunate too. I have a gentleman in my life, Dave Sherrick, and he has been my mentor. I got lucky. We met a few years ago, and he saw something in me. But Dave Sherrick is a Whiskey Advocate Lifetime Achievement Award winner, but he's the person that put Woodford Reserve on the map. He's the one that unshuttered it and restored it and worked with Lincoln Henderson and you know, that crew there to get Woodford up and running. He's the one that picked up the, you know, the iconic pot stills in Scotland and came back, and they were doing the only pot distillations at the time. And so, you know, he certainly didn't have any bias about me being female, you know.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have and justifiably so, I think in a lot of corners of the industry as it relates to whiskey and really, you know, bourbon and whiskey in the United States, it's sort of a good old boys club. I think we know one of the things that's also very interesting is there's this sort of perception of it's a good old boys club, it's sort of a good old boys white guy club, and that's who drinks it. And I think we know that actually those that make up the population in a growing sense that drink whiskey and drink bourbon globally, really, that market share is increasingly female.
Yes, absolutely. And I came at this late in life, but more and more too, we're seeing, you know, like mother daughters, like Joyce Nethery and her daughter Autumn at Jephthah Creed in Kentucky. My oldest daughter, she and her husband opened a restaurant in Bardstown, knocked it out of the park, and he got discovered as the executive chef for Maker's Mark. But she, my daughter, has come on strong. She's starting to get recognized for her palate, and, you know, she gets to go on some single barrel picks because she's really good at what she does. And so it's like my mentor too, you know, his daughter is also in the industry, and there's some father-daughter combinations, so that's interesting to see mother-daughter combinations and the father-daughter combination as well.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we know in many instances, a lot of these people that we're talking about, these noted names, we're talking about, it's a generational business, especially like in Kentucky, so it's great to see that representation actually changing as well. That's really cool.
Right, and none of us, like on the Nashville Whiskey panel last week, none of us have a pedigree. Not a single one of us got into the business because. So one of the questions that was asked at the end that was really interesting is like, do you have anybody following you into the industry, right? And so everybody had a different answer, but I thought it was a really great question.
That's really cool. Interesting. Thank you for sharing your perspective on that. I really appreciate it, Lisa.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this because, you know, we got another few minutes here. Let's talk a little bit further. It's an interesting still setup you have here.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk a little bit about as you've wrapped your hands around this and moving forward, what we can expect from Widow Jane, with different expressions of whiskey, and just kind of how you guys are going to go about things moving forward and what you're up to now.
Well, because of my background and my personal preferences, we will be a pot distilled whiskey. We'll probably be not probably, you know, we're going to end up being having a hybrid system. I haven't worked through everything yet, what we're thinking exactly, but ultimately finishing in a pot still is like near and dear to my heart. Right now we run one pass whiskey through the pot with the beer column. It's beautiful with the heirloom corns. It keeps a lot of the character in the heirloom.
Can you describe that for a second, just for people out there? What would be the difference? What are you getting from the heirloom versus, you know, just kind of your garden variety, no pun intended, corn?
Well, you know, the analogy I use all the time is people are now familiar with heirloom tomatoes, right?
Yep.
You've got the Kroger, no offense to Kroger, Kroger Red Hot House, you know, hybrid variety that they all look the same. They can all be, you know, they've been bred to be able to all fit in the same, you know, packing crate, right, without getting bruised or, yeah, or broken or whatever. And so, you know, we all know that texture, right? And you also, then you, if you've ever gone to the farmer's market, you've already grown them yourself, you've got these gorgeous heirloom tomatoes. They're all misshapen. The colors are fabulous, but they have breaks in them and some brown marks on them. And they're too perishable to ship very well, right?
Right. Yep.
So because you put a knife into them and they just, they're so wonderful and full of tomato juice and things that they just, you know, they sort of disintegrate. And so that is the difference between heirloom corn and standard yellow dent. There's absolutely nothing wrong with yellow dent corn. I do, you know, everybody seems to be sticking to non-GMO, but that's just all personal decisions on that. And or, you know, or the Red Hot House tomato, right? There's nothing wrong with those products at all. This is not any judgment on that. But there's just so much flavor and variety available using heirloom corn, especially if you're trying to do a different expression of whiskey and make yourself stand apart. And so we have a one-of-a-kind corn. You know, we've got this open pollinated cross, and nobody else has it. It's called Baby Jane.
Okay.
You know, and so that'll set us apart. That, you know, and we've got a one-of-a-kind barrel profile. We've been fortunate to work with Zach Cooperidge out of Atherton'sville, Kentucky. It was an old Seagram's plant at one time, went out of business when all the whiskey distilleries were going out of business in the 80s. A gentleman named Bert Zeimlich brought it back. He was with the Brown-Forman Cooperage, and now his son and grandson run it, and they have started working with craft distillers, and so have some beautiful, beautiful air-seasoned wood. Some of it rather old, and it makes beautiful barrels, but I've worked with them, and we've got a one-of-a-kind barrel finish. So we're going to have a one-of-a-kind corn with one-of-a-kind water and a one-of-a-kind barrel.
And that's it. And it's exceedingly difficult to make yourself distinct these days with whiskey, is it not? And even bourbon in particular, I think, in just my personal view.
It is. And, you know, and you also risk, too. And, you know, and I've done some client work like this, too, where you start to you have to be careful how far you go, right, with some of the experimentation and things, because we still want a solid traditional product.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, heirloom corn is kind of viewed as all the corn going into whiskey a couple hundred years ago was heirloom corn. You know, it
sure
wasn't the yellow, standard yellow dent that we're used to now. So, you know, as you're trying to bring, there's some characteristics when I get an opportunity to taste some rather old whiskey that I just love. There's a menthol quality sometimes that comes through. There's a minty quality comes through. You know, there's something that's so tannic that it almost starts to soften. That, you know, it's like tannin that fell over the cliff, right? You know, it starts to get kind of silky, although it's still kind of pungent. And you know, and so I keep experimenting too with the corns and things too, to see if we can't, you know, is it just because they're so old? Is the oak different? And is the oak in the barrels different? You know, is it just because somebody walked away from these barrels and just let them sit?
Some oxidation, right? Things like that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Did they pick up some of this characteristic in the bottle because of being, you know, hot or cold or whatever?
Sure.
But, you know, there's certainly some of those characteristics that I'm always driven to find.
Yeah, you know, Lisa, you raise a really interesting point, and I don't want to go too far off track here, but talking about how, you know, these bourbons and whiskeys were going to all be originally made with technically what is heirloom corn. And we have these guys that come on the show about once a quarter, and they're beer experts. And one of the show that we just did a show last week, 2 weeks ago, on sort of the broader category, if you will, it's not a true category, but sour beers. And we were talking about how if you go back 120 or so years before, you know, all the pasteurization process and things being totally clean and sterilized in beer making, probably all beer going back multiple millennia was sour because you're going to have wild yeast intrusion in this.
Yes, so Brettanomyces is everywhere, right?
Brett is everywhere, and the different, you know, as I like to say, right. the various caucuses, you know, that are out right. there and so on and so forth are right. out there. Absolutely. And I think because, and where I'm kind of going with this as it relates to whiskeys and bourbons and these sorts of things is that, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, like they'll say, oh, these newfangled sour beers. Well, it's like, right. you know, go ask the Flemish in Belgium. Right. It's not newfangled at all. And the same thing with what you're talking about going on with traditional products and traditional ingredients, I should say, being used in bourbon. I think some of the nice and whiskeys in general and some of the nice things that people are doing, it's a interesting, more relevant, I would say, historically expression and effort, if that's fair
right.
to say.
And we fall back on winemaking again, where we, you know, it's part of the terroir, right? It's,
yep.
It's the building contributes that, you know, just as much as the where the whiskey's aged and what kind of oak that it went into and where the corn came from. And really, you know, it's all about putting your own signature on it.
It's great. And this is really lovely stuff that you're tasting. Let me ask you this really quick question, because just because you mentioned Michael Veach's name, and I've met Michael in passing once or twice when he's been down here in New Orleans, and I always find it very interesting, and I'm not going to hold you to this, but his theory about how the name Bourbon comes from Bourbon Street, we've talked about that on the show, as opposed
yes.
to Bourbon County. Where do you
yes.
fall? How, do you buy where he's coming from on that?
Mike's a dear friend. I have to be careful. Yes, absolutely.
He's a fine author. Just say a great book. Go
yes.
read his book.
My little personal twist on it, and I have not, you know, Mike's got the history to back all this stuff up,
sure.
right? You know, and some of mine is just gut feeling, but you know, you start to live in Bardstown, and, you know, it's got a really heavy French influence there. Gethsemane, it's, like I said, that, you know, these French, it's a monastery that was founded in the mid-19th century, and they're still there. They're French Trappist monks.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's such a French influence there, too. I sometimes wonder if there weren't some of the whiskey makers setting some back because they only had grain. They didn't have grapes. And so in order to imitate cognac, I think, you know, my gut tells me that there might have been a little bit of that type of experimentation going
sense.
On as well.
Sure.
Right, right. But I do agree with Mike, you know, it's because it, ultimately what the destination is more than origin back in the day. I think it would have been well better known on Bourbon Street than it would have been in Bourbon County, Kentucky.
You know, and it could have very just easily been a term of, I mean, I kind of almost wonder because of the reasons you just gave him, and I'm drawing a blank, Mike makes the case in his book of the two grocers that came from a cognac mm-hmm. producing family that mm-hmm. opened up the, I guess, grocery distribution or produce distribution up in Lexington, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Up in
mm-hmm.
Kentucky. And, you know, it might just kind of been, hey, bourbon, it just kind of fits, right? People are drinking it
yes.
on Bourbon Street. Bourbon County's right next door. You know, we were named after the bourbons in France. We got the monks. We got all this. And all this stuff tastes a hell of a lot better if it's aged in wood.
you yes.
know? Yes. It all just kind of yes. maybe fits in, just sort of fell into place, perhaps. I know that's not very strong on historical analysis, but it
right.
does make
and
sense.
And something Steve Bayshore talks about at Mount Vernon when I'm out there, too, is the fact that barrels got reused all the time. And so and the only way to sanitize them, if you had salt fish in them and then you're thinking, well, this is the only container that I have. I've got to put my whiskey in it now. You're going to burn out the inside of it.
Right. Absolutely.
To sanitize it and to neutralize it and sanitize it. So, you know, they're not going to have the luxury of what we do now. We recoup our barrels, right? We take them apart and refinish them and put them all back together. And you know, in the spirit of economy, they wouldn't have done that. They would have just said, okay, let's burn it up and clean it up, right? So,
yep.
You know, so it's obvious that, you know, maybe whiskey going into a brand new oak barrel might not have the same characteristics as one that was put into a charred or even recharred barrel.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And ones that have been stripped mm-hmm. down. I think, you know, Mike mm-hmm. makes that case with the salt fish stuff that if,
mm-hmm.
once it's had salt fish in it, that you're not getting rid of that entirely, no matter how much
right.
you char it or pare it down.
Yes. right. yes, that's where the cocktail comes in,
that,
right?
There you go. I love that saline note. You know, it tastes like Caesar dressing. It's fantastic. But...
Exactly.
Well, great. Lisa, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to chat with you today and very informative. And I hope you do make it down here to New Orleans because it would be great to share a little Widow Jane with you when you do make
I
it down this
that.
Way. Yeah, you
I
know,
would
we
love that.
We do have that bourbon festival that started here. I think we're coming into the third iteration
right.
in the spring
right.
That a friend of the show here, Tracy Napolitano, puts on. So hopefully,
yes.
maybe
yes.
You know Tracy? Yeah, so hopefully you get a chance to come down here and check that out. I think it's March or April, if I remember right, coming up.
Yes, absolutely. I would love to do that. I would love to do that.
Great. Friends,
thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Tails. I think Tails is always.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll see you, Tails. That's a foregone conclusion, right? Yeah. There you
right,
go.
Right.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Lisa. I really, really appreciate it.
And thank you. Okay.
My pleasure. Friends, that we were just chatting with Lisa Wicker, who is the distiller at Widow Jane Distillery up in Brooklyn, New York. Go check out widowjane.com. You can just search for Widow Jane Distillery online. Really fine products, and they're doing things, making great things happen in the world of whiskey here in the U.S. Friends, we're going to take just a brief musical interlude here on another shot with Noel Drinks, and I'll be back with my parting shot. Come on back. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show this week. Really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed that fun conversation that we had with Lisa Wicker of Widow Jane Distillery up there in Brooklyn, New York. Friends, wanted to mention over the next couple weeks, we've got a couple great shows coming up for you. Haven't figured out the exact order, what's going to air next week and then what's going to air the week after. But these two really good shows, one will be featuring Jim Clark, who is with Wines of South Africa. We're going to be talking about that fascinating wine producing country, learn more about the wines, probably taste through some stuff. It's a fascinating history. It's a really cool area that's continues to be up and coming and continues to improve year after year. Always fun to have Jim on. We usually have him on once a year when he's here in town. And that will be leading up to an event taking place November 7th through the 13th at various venues around New Orleans, South African Wine Week, something that we're involved in and happy to support. And you can check that out if you're here in town. Great event to go check out and explore South African wines. There's all kinds of stuff happening at different venues. They're all kind of doing their own thing. You might find some flights. You might find some bottles or glasses featured at happy hour. Some people are doing dedicated paired dinners. Some people are just doing suggested paired menus that you can kind of get throughout the week. All kinds of different things going on. So that's absolutely worth checking out. So we'll air that show, talk more about that event, talk with Jim. And then we also have another, it's connected to an event, another great event going on, kind of overlapping there on November 9th, Boudin Bourbon and Beer, which is a terrific charity event that helps support various children's causes, a lot of education stuff, building their futures. And that's put on by the Emeril Lagasse Foundation. And it's a terrific event. It takes place at Champion Square, which is adjacent to the New Orleans Superdome, of course, where the New Orleans Saints play. And it features, I don't even know how many. It's like 80 or 90, I think, this year, chefs. And it's the actual executive chefs from the restaurants that turn up. They don't send staff. It's them. They're all expected to be there. There's all kinds of drink. There's all kinds of food. The whole idea, obviously, it's Boudin, bourbon, and beer. So everybody usually has some sort of take on Boudin, using Boudin. And there's a pretty wide latitude given in what people do. Really cool event. But to that end, who we chat with, we will be talking with three fantastic, really important noted chefs here in New Orleans. Frank Brightson of Brightson's, Isaac Toops of Toops Meadery and Toops South, and Philip Lopez, who is the executive chef at the famed restaurant Galatoire's. These guys are at the top of their field. Fascinating conversation that we'll have with them about cooking in South Louisiana, understanding some of the different traditions, some of the differences, and of course, we'll talk about the great event, Boudin Bourbon and Beer. Friends, here's our parting shot. As I mentioned, coming into another shot with Noel Drinks, talking a little bit about some record-breaking bottles being sold at auction. And so not too long ago, actually, if you're listening this week, so it was on Monday, I think it must have taken place over the weekend, two bottles of the 1945 vintage of the Domaine de la Romanée Conti wine, Burgundy, sold at auction, as I said, at Sotheby's there in New York. One bottle went for $496,000. Another bottle went for $558,000. I guess that second buyer probably panicked a little bit and went, man, I missed out on that one for just shy of a half a mil. So now I've got to drop about another 60 to actually get a bottle. Yeah, 60K. Oh, yeah. The wines are being offered as part of the collection from the cellar of Robert Druhan. Hopefully I'm saying that right. And it was a consignment of old and rare DRC wines. 100% of everything in the collection sold, and it sold for the total bill, if you will, for everybody that bought out of that collection was $7.3 million. Yes, that was nearly five times its pre-sale high estimate. This is a report in the drinks business, by the way. Now, at that same sale, also, a bottle of 1926 Macallan Scotch with a label, a limited edition label that was done by the pop artist Sir Peter Blake, sold for $843,200. Okay, just one bottle. Now, that actually didn't break the record for the same bottle. Okay. That actually went to, there was, well, what happened was is Macallan's in 1986 bottled 24 bottles of its 1926 60-year-old Macallan Scotch there from Speyside. And so they did that, and they did 12 bottles that had a label done by the Italian Valerio Adami, and then another 12 by the aforementioned Sir Peter Blake. And of course, yeah, thanks. It comes in this nice brass and glass presentation case. Yeah, okay, you better put it in there. But so this one sold, as I said, for $843,000, $843,200. Yeah. And $843,200. There you go. See, the number is so large, I can't even actually say it. Now, over in the Bonhams, which was in the UK, a bottle of the 1926 60-year-old with the label by Valerio Adami sold for £848,750. That's about $1.12 million, folks. And there was a bottle of the same that sold in Hong Kong not too long ago, earlier this year, that went for £814,081, which is about $1.07 million. Okay? Wow. So they're talking about these ones. They don't know exactly how many bottles still exist. One, it has been known to have been drunk. One was reportedly destroyed in the Japanese earthquake of 2011. And Sotheby's is actually, well, I think there's still one more that's going to be going up on auction here pretty quick and might actually break that record. But friends, we're talking about, you know, more than $1 million U.S. for a bottle of scotch. Now, it's kind of funny because I got onto the Whiskey Exchange website just looking for some information, and they were talking about the Macallan 1926, the one with the Peter Blake label. And yeah, you know, it's 60-year-old, as I mentioned, 1926, 60-year-old, there you go, as I mentioned. Still, again, I'm just stunned by the amount of money that we're talking about here. 1926 vintage, and it's from Speyside, as I said. And my favorite part, though, when you're looking at the website for the Whiskey Exchange, is it says, when you can kind of like do the little shopping cart thing, it says, this product is currently out of stock. You think? And then it says notify me. So I think I'll click on that and tell me if one just happens to come to the Whiskey Exchange. And then there's also a place where you can add it to your wish list, which is probably the most likely thing that I would ever do. I'm going to just put it on my wish list and see, maybe somebody will gift it to me when they happen to be looking at my account. But my thought was, hey, you know, when you start considering, you know, well over $500,000 for a bottle of 1945 Burgundy, well over $1 million for a bottle of 60-year-old Macallan Scotch, if I had that kind of money, let's say, you know, $1 million burning a hole in my pocket, I think, well, what I would probably do, I would probably just buy a boat. I'd buy a yacht, and then I'd buy a whole bunch of Macallan and a whole bunch of Burgundy, you know, that you can currently find in the store, and throw one hell of a party. That's kind of my thought there. But, you know, here's a thought question for you. That's what I would do if I had that kind of money burning a hole in my pocket, which I really don't. But if you were to buy a bottle like this, so I mentioned that one of those Macallans had already been drunk or was known to have been drunk. What do you do? Do you drink it? Do you put it on, you know, it's like the scotch, as I mentioned, comes in this nice brass and wood case thing. Do you put that on display in some center area of your home just to flaunt it over people and let them know that you have it? I don't know. If you decide to drink it, who do you invite? Do you just invite your good friends, even if they're a bunch of yahoos and they don't really know much about scotch? Or do you invite your enemies or people that you're trying to impress to say, hey, look, I got this bottle of 1926 Macallan and you don't, but I'll give you a little taste. Do you open it up and taste it in front of them and not let them taste it? I have no idea, when you turn around and you buy a bottle of something like this, just what the hell you do with it. But these are problems that I, and I'm sure all of you listening out there, will never have. Well, and if you run into one, hey, more power to you. Invite me. I'll come over and drink it with you. Friends, thanks again for tuning in this week. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.